Chapter 13 Babylon. With the basest of companions, I walked the streets of Babylon. Augustine, Confessions 2, 3. The Cray-21 mainframe computer at Argus had been instructed to compare each day's harvest of data from Vega with the earliest records of Level 3 of the Palimpsest. In effect, one long and incomprehensible sequence of zeros and ones was being compared automatically with another, earlier such sequence. This was part of a massive statistical intercomparison of various segments of the still undecrypted text. There were some short sequences of zeros and ones, words, the analysts called them hopefully, which were repeated again and again. Many sequences would appear only once in thousands of pages of text. This statistical approach to message decryption was familiar to Ellie since high school. But the subroutines, supplied by the experts from the National Security Agency, made available only as a result of a presidential directive, and even then armed with instructions to self-destruct if examined closely, were brilliant. What prodigies of human inventiveness, Ellie reflected, were being directed to reading each other's mail. The global confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union, now, to be sure, easing somewhat, was still eating up the world. It was not just the financial resources dedicated to the military establishments of all nations. That was approaching $2 trillion a year. And by itself was ruinously expensive when there were so many other urgent human needs. But still worse, she knew, was the intellectual effort dedicated to the arms race. Almost half the scientists on the planet, it had been estimated, were employed by one or another of the almost 200 military establishments worldwide. And they were not the dregs of the doctoral programs in physics and mathematics. Some of her colleagues would console themselves with this thought when the awkward problem arose of what to tell a recent doctoral candidate being courted by, say, one of the weapons laboratories.
If he was any good, he'd be offered an assistant professorship at Stanford, at least,
she could recall Drumlin once saying. Nope, a certain kind of mind and character was drawn to the military applications of science and mathematics. People who liked big explosions, for example. Or those with no taste for personal combat, who, to avenge some schoolyard injustice, aspired to military command. Or inveterate puzzle solvers, who longed to decrypt the most complex messages known. Occasionally the spur was political, tracing back to international disputes, immigration policies, wartime horrors, police brutality, or national propaganda by this nation or that decades earlier. Many of these scientists had real ability, Ellie knew, whatever reservations she might have about their motivations. She tried to imagine that massed talent really dedicated to the well-being of the species and the planet. She pored over the studies that had accumulated during her absence. They were making almost no progress in decrypting the message, although the statistical analyses now stacked into a pile of paper a meter tall. It was all very discouraging. She wished there were someone, especially a close woman friend at Argus, to whom she could pour out her hurt and anger at Ken's behavior. But there was not, and she was disinclined even to use the telephone for this purpose. She did manage to spend a weekend with her college friend Becky Ellenbogen in Austin. But Becky, whose appraisals of men tended to be somewhere between wry and scathing, in this case was surprisingly mild in her criticism.
"He is the president's science advisor, and this is only the most amazing discovery in the history of the world. Don't be so hard on him," Becky urged. "He'll come around."
But Becky was another of those who found Ken charming. She had met him once at the dedication of the National Neutrino Observatory and was perhaps too inclined to accommodate to power. Had Drahir treated Ellie in this shabby way while he was a mere professor of molecular biology somewhere, Becky would have marinated and skewered the man. After returning from Paris, Drahir had mustered a regular campaign of apology and devotion. He had been overstressed, he told her, overwhelmed with a range of responsibilities, including difficult and unfamiliar political issues. His position as leader of the American delegation
and co-chairman of the plenary, might have been rendered less effective if there had been public knowledge of his and Ellie's relationship. Kit's had been insufferable. Ken had had too many consecutive nights with only a few hours' sleep. Altogether, Ellie judged, there were too many explanations, but she permitted the relationship to continue. When it happened, it was Willie once again, this time on the graveyard shift, who first noticed. Afterward, Willie would attribute the speed of the discovery less to the superconducting computer and the NSA programs than to the new Haddon context recognition chips. At any rate, Vega had been low in the sky an hour or so before dawn when the computer triggered an understated alarm. With some annoyance, Willie put down what he was reading. It was a new textbook on fast Fourier transform spectroscopy, and noticed these words being printed out on the screen. Repeat text pages 41,617 to 41,619. Bit mismatch 0/2271. Correlation coefficient 0.99 plus. As he watched, 41,619 became 41,620, and then 41,621. The digits after the slash were increasing in a continuous blur. Both the number of pages and the correlation coefficient, a measure of the improbability that the correlation was by chance, increased as he watched. He gave it another 2 pages before picking up the direct line to Ellie's apartment. She had been in a deep sleep and was momentarily disoriented, but she quickly turned on the bedside light and after a moment gave instructions for senior Argus staff to be assembled. She would, she told him, locate Jahir, who was somewhere on the facility. This proved not very difficult. She shook his shoulder. Ken, get up. There's word that we've repeated.
What?
The message has cycled back. Or at least, that's what Willie says. I'm on my way there. Why don't you wait another 10 minutes so we can pretend you were in your room in BSQ? She was almost at the door before he shouted after her, how can we recycle? We haven't gotten the primer yet. Racing across the screens was a paired sequence of zeros and ones, a real-time comparison of the data just being received and the data from an early page of text received at Argus a year before. The program would have culled out any differences. So far, there were none. It reassured them that they had not mistranscribed, that there were no apparent transmission errors, and that if some small, dense interstellar cloud between Vega and the Earth was able to eat the occasional zero or one, this was an infrequent occurrence. Argus was by now in real-time communication with dozens of other telescopes that were part of the World Message Consortium, and the news of recycling was passed on to the next observing stations westward, to California, Hawaii, the Marshall Nedelin now in the South Pacific, and to Sydney. Had the discovery been made when Vega was over one of the other telescopes in the network, Argus would have been informed instantly. The absence of the primer was an agonizing disappointment, but it was not the only surprise. The message page numbers had jumped discontinuously from the 40,000s to the 10,000s, where recycling had been uncovered. Evidently, Argus had discovered the transmission from Vega almost at the moment it first arrived at Earth. It was a remarkably strong signal and would have been picked up even by small, omnidirectional telescopes. But it was a surprising coincidence that the broadcast should arrive at Earth at the very moment Argus was looking at Vega. Also, what did it mean for the text to begin on a page in the 10,000s? Were there 10,000 pages of text missing? Was it a backward practice of the provincial Earth to start numbering books on page one? Were these sequential numbers perhaps not page numbers but something else? Or, and this worried Ellie the most, was there some fundamental and unexpected difference between how humans thought of things and how the aliens thought? If so, it would have worrisome implications about the ability of the consortium to understand the message, primer or no primer. The message repeated exactly. The gaps were all filled in and nobody could read a word of it. It seemed unlikely that the transmitting civilization, meticulous in all else, had simply overlooked the need for a primer. At least the Olympic broadcast and the interior design of the machine seemed to be tailored specifically for humans. They would hardly go to all this trouble to devise and transmit the message without making some provision for humans to read it. So humans must have overlooked something. It soon became generally agreed that somewhere was a fourth layer to the palimpsest. But where? The diagrams were published in an 8-volume coffee table book set that was soon reprinted worldwide. All over the planet, people tried to figure out the pictures. The dodecahedron and the quasi-biological forms were especially evocative. Many clever suggestions were made by the public and carefully sifted by the Argus team. Many harebrained interpretations were also widely available, especially in weekly newspapers. Whole new industries developed, doubtless unforeseen by those who devised the message, dedicated to using the diagrams to bilk the public. The ancient and mystical order of the dodecahedron was announced. The machine was a UFO. The machine was Ezekiel's wheel. An angel revealed the meaning of the message in the diagrams to a Brazilian businessman who distributed, at first at his own expense, his interpretation worldwide. With so many enigmatic diagrams to interpret, it was inevitable that many religions would recognize some of their iconography in the message from the stars. A principal cross-section of the machine looked something like a chrysanthemum, a fact that stirred great enthusiasm in Japan. If there had been an image of a human face among all the diagrams, messianic fervor might have reached a flashpoint. As it was, a surprisingly large number of people were winding up their affairs in preparation for the advent. Industrial productivity was off worldwide. Many had given away all their possessions to the poor, and then, as the end of the world was delayed, were obliged to seek help from a charity or the state. Because gifts of this sort constituted a major fraction of the resources of such charities, some of the philanthropists ended up being supported by their own gifts. Delegations approached government leaders to urge that schistomiasis, say, or world hunger be ended by the advent. Otherwise, there was no telling what would happen to us. Others counseled more quietly that if there was a decade of real world madness in the offing, there must be a considerable monetary or national advantage in it somewhere. Some said that there was no primer, that the whole exercise was to teach humans humility or to drive us mad. There were newspaper editorials on how we're not as smart as we think we are, and some resentment directed at the scientists who, after all the support given to them by the governments, have failed us in our time of need. Or maybe humans are much dumber than the vegans gave us credit for. Maybe there was some point that had been entirely obvious to all previous emerging civilizations so contacted, something no one in the history of the galaxy had ever missed before. A few commentators embraced this prospect of cosmic humiliation with real enthusiasm. It demonstrated what they'd been saying about people all along. After a while, Ellie decided that she needed help. They entered surreptitiously through the Enlil gate, with an escort dispatched by the proprietor. The General Services Administration security detail was edgy, despite or perhaps because of the additional protection. Although there was a little sunlight still left, the dirt streets were lit by braziers, oil lamps, and an occasional guttering torch. Two amphoras, each large enough to contain an adult human being, flanked the entrance to a retail olive oil establishment. The advertising was in cuneiform. On an adjacent public building was a magnificent bas-relief of a lion hunt from the reign of Assurbanipal. As they approached the Temple of Assur, there was a scuffle in the crowd, and her escort made a wide berth. She now had an unobstructed view of the ziggurat down a wide, torch-lit avenue. It was more breathtaking than in the pictures. There was a martial flourish on an unfamiliar brass instrument. Three men and a horse clattered by, the charioteer in Phrygian headdress. As in some medieval rendition of a cautionary tale from the Book of Genesis, the top of the ziggurat was enveloped in low, twilight clouds. They left the Ishtarian Way and entered the ziggurat through a side street. In the private elevator, her escort pressed the button for the topmost floor. 40, it read. No numerals, just the word. And then, to leave no room for doubt, a glass panel flashed, "The Gods." Mr. Haddon would be with her shortly. Would she like something to drink while she waited? Considering the reputation of the place, Ellie demurred. Babylon lay spread out before her, magnificent, as everyone said, in its recreation of a long-gone time and place. During daylight hours, busloads from museums, a very few schools, and the tourist agencies would arrive at the Ishtar Gate, don appropriate clothes, and travel back in time. Haddon wisely donated all profits from his daytime clientele to New York City and Long Island charities. The daytime tours were immensely popular, in part because it was a respectable opportunity to look the place over for those who would not dream of visiting Babylon at night. Well, maybe they would dream. After dark, Babylon was called an adult amusement park. It was of an opulence, scale, and imaginativeness that dwarfed, say, the Reeperbahn in Hamburg. It was by far the largest tourist attraction in the New York metropolitan area, with by far the largest gross revenues. How Haddon had been able to convince the city fathers of Babylon, New York, and how he had lobbied for an easement of local and state prostitution laws was well known. It was now a half-hour train ride from Midtown Manhattan to the Ishtar Gate. Ellie had insisted on taking this train, despite the entreaties of the security people, and had found almost a third of the visitors to be women. There were no graffiti, little danger of mugging, but a much inferior brand of white noise compared with the conveyances of the New York City subway system. Although Haddon was a member of the National Academy of Engineering, he had never, so far as Ellie knew, attended a meeting, and she had never set eyes on him. His face became well known to millions of Americans, however, years before, as a result of the Advertising Council's campaign against him. "The Un-American" had been the caption under an unflattering portrait of Haddon. Even so, she was taken aback when, in the midst of her reverie by the slanted glass wall, she was interrupted by a small, fat, beckoning person. "Oh, sorry. I never understand how anyone can be afraid of me." His voice was surprisingly musical. In fact, he seemed to talk in fifths. He hadn't thought it necessary to introduce himself, and once again inclined his head to the door he had left ajar. It was hard to believe that some crime of passion was about to be visited upon her under these circumstances, and wordlessly, she entered the next room. He ushered her to a meticulously crafted tabletop model of an ancient city of less pretentious aspect than Babylon. "Pompeii," he said by way of explanation. "The stadium here is the key. With the restrictions on boxing, there aren't any healthy blood sports left in America. Very important. Sucks out some of the poisons from the national bloodstream. The whole thing is designed, permits issued, and now this."
"What's this?"
"No gladiatorial games. I just got word from Sacramento. There's a bill before the legislature to outlaw gladiatorial games in California. Too violent, they say. They authorize a new skyscraper. They know they'll lose two or three construction workers. The unions know, the builders know. And that's just to build offices for oil companies or Beverly Hills lawyers. Oh, sure, we'd lose a few. But we're geared more to trident and net than the short sword. Those legislators don't have their priorities straight." He beamed at her owlishly and offered a drink, which again she refused. "So you want to talk to me about the machine, and I want to talk to you about the machine. You first. You want to know where the primer is? We're asking for help from a few key people who might have some insight. We thought with your record of invention, and since your context recognition chip was involved in the recycling discovery, that you might put yourself in the place of the Vegans and think of where you'd put the primer. We recognize you're very busy, and I'm sorry to..." "Oh, no, it's all right. It's true, I'm busy. I'm trying to regularize my affairs, because I'm going to make a big change in my life." "For the millennium?" She tried to imagine him giving away S.R. Haddon and Company, the Wall Street brokerage house, Genetic Engineering Incorporated,
Haddon Cybernetics, and Babylon to the poor. Not exactly. No. It was fun to think about. It made me feel good to be asked. I looked at the diagrams. He waved at the commercial set of 8 volumes spread in disarray on a work table. There are wonderful things in there, but I don't think that's where the primer is hiding. Not in the diagrams. I don't know why you think the primer has to be in the message. Maybe they left it on Mars or Pluto or in the Oort comet cloud, and we'll discover it in a few centuries. Right now, we know there's this wonderful machine with design drawings and 30,000 pages of explanatory text. But we don't know whether we'd be able to build the thing if we could read it. So we wait a few centuries, improving our technology, knowing that sooner or later we'll have to be ready to build it. Not having the primer binds us up with future generations. Human beings are sent a problem that takes generations to solve. I don't think that's such a bad thing. Might be very healthy. Maybe you're making a mistake looking for a primer. Maybe it's better not to find it. No, I want to find the primer right away. We don't know it'll be waiting for us forever. If they hang up because there was no answer, it would be much worse than if they'd never called at all. Well, maybe you have a point. Anyway, I thought of as many possibilities as I could. I'll give you a couple of trivial possibilities and then a non-trivial possibility. Trivial first. The primer's in the message, but at a very different data rate. Suppose there was another message in there, at a bit an hour. Could you detect that? Absolutely. We routinely check for long-term receiver drift in any case, but also a bit an hour only buys you, let me see, 10,000-20,000 bits tops before the message recycles. So that makes sense only if the primer is much easier than the message. You think it isn't. I think it isn't. Now, what about much faster bit rates? How do you know that under every bit of your machine message, there aren't a million bits of primer message? Because it would produce monster bandwidths. We'd know in an instant. Okay, so there's a fast data dump every now and then. Think of it as microfilm. There's a tiny dot of microfilm that's sitting in repetitive parts of the message. I'm imagining a little box that says in your regular language, I am the primer. Then right after that, there's a dot. And in that dot is 100 million bits, very fast. You might see if you've got any boxes. Believe me, we would have seen it. Okay, how about phase modulation? We use it in radar and spacecraft telemetry, and it hardly messes up the spectrum at all. Have you hooked up a phase correlator? No, that's a useful idea. I'll look into it. Now, the non-trivial idea is this. If the machine ever gets made, if our people are going to sit in it, somebody's going to press a button, and then those 5 are going to go somewhere. Never mind where. Now, there's an interesting question whether those 5 are going to come back. Maybe not. I like the idea that all this machine design was invented by vegan body snatchers. You know, they're medical students or anthropologists or something. They need a few human bodies. Oh, it's a big hassle to come to Earth. You need permission, passes from the transit authority. Oh, hell, it's more trouble than it's worth. But with a little effort, you can send the Earth a message. And then the Earthlings go to all the trouble to ship you 5 bodies. It's like stamp collecting. I used to collect stamps when I was a kid. You could send a letter to somebody in a foreign country, and most of the time they'd write back. It didn't matter what they said. All you wanted was a stamp. So that's my picture. There's a few stamp collectors on Vega. They send letters out when they're in the mood, and bodies come flying back to them from all over space. Wouldn't you like to see the collection? He smiled up at her and continued, Okay. So what does this have to do with finding the primer? Nothing. It's relevant only if I'm wrong. If my picture is wrong, if the 5 people are coming back to Earth, then it would be a big help if we've invented spaceflight. No matter how smart they are, it's going to be tough to land the machine. Too many things are moving. God knows what the propulsion system is. If you pop out of space a few meters below ground, you've had it. And what's a few meters in 26 light years? It's too risky. When the machine comes back, it'll pop out.
or whatever it does, in space, somewhere near the Earth. But not on it, or in it. So they have to be sure we have spaceflight, so the five people can be rescued in space. They're in a hurry and can't sit tight until the 1957 evening news arrives on Vega. So what do? They arrange so part of the message can only be detected from space. What part is that? The primer. If you can detect the primer, you've got spaceflight, and you can come back safe. So I imagine the primer is being sent at the frequency of the oxygen absorptions in the microwave spectrum, or in the near-infrared. Some part of the spectrum you can't detect until you're well out of the Earth's atmosphere. We've had the Hubble telescope looking at Vega all through the ultraviolet, visible and near-infrared. Not a hint of anything. The Russians have repaired their millimeter wave instrument. They've hardly been looking at anything besides Vega, and they haven't found anything. But we'll keep looking. Other possibilities? Sure you wouldn't like a drink? I don't drink myself, but so many people do. Ellie again declined. No other possibilities. And now it's my turn. You see, I want to ask you for something. But I'm not good at asking for things. I never have been. My public image is rich, funny-looking, unscrupulous. Somebody who looks for weaknesses in the system so he can make a fast buck. And don't tell me you don't believe any of that. Everybody believes at least some of it. You've probably heard some of what I'm going to say before, but give me 10 minutes and I'll tell you how all this began. I want you to know something about me. She settled back, wondering what he could possibly want of her, and brushed away idle fantasies involving the Temple of Ishtar, Hadden, and perhaps a charioteer or two thrown in for good measure. Years before, he had invented a module that, when a television commercial appeared, automatically muted the sound. It wasn't at first a context recognition device. Instead, it simply monitored the amplitude of the carrier wave. TV advertisers had taken to running their ads louder and with less audio clutter than the programs that were their nominal vehicles. News of Haddon's module spread by word of mouth. People reported a sense of relief, the lifting of a great burden, even a feeling of joy at being freed from the advertising barrage for the 6 to 8 hours out of every day that the average American spent in front of the television set. Before there could be any coordinated response from the television advertising industry, AdNics had become wildly popular. It forced advertisers and networks into new choices of carrier wave strategy, each of which had encountered with a new invention. Sometimes he invented circuits to defeat strategies that the agencies and the networks had not yet hit upon. He would say that he was saving them the trouble of making inventions, at great cost to their shareholders, which were at any rate doomed to failure. As his sales volume increased, he kept cutting prices. It was a kind of electronic warfare, and he was winning. They tried to sue him, something about a conspiracy and restraint of trade. They had sufficient political muscle that his motion for summary dismissal was denied, but insufficient influence to actually win the case. The trial had forced Haddon to investigate the relevant legal codes. Soon after, he applied through a well-known Madison Avenue agency in which he was now a major silent partner to advertise his own product on commercial television. After a few weeks of controversy, his commercials were refused. He sued all three networks, and in this trial was able to prove conspiracy in restraint of trade. He received a huge settlement that was at the time a record for cases of this sort, and which contributed, in its modest way, to the demise of the original networks. There had always been people who enjoyed the commercials, of course, and they had no need for AdNics. But they were a dwindling minority. Haddon made a great fortune by eviscerating broadcast advertising. He also made many enemies. By the time context recognition chips were commercially available, he was ready with PreachNics, a sub-module which could be plugged into AdNics. It would simply switch channels if, by chance, a doctrinaire religious program should be tuned in. You could pre-select keywords such as Advent or Rapture and cut great swathes through the available programming.
Preachniks was a godsend for a long-suffering but significant minority of television viewers. There was talk, some of it half-serious, that Haddon's next submodule would be called Jiveniks and would work only on public addresses by presidents and premiers. As he further developed context recognition chips, it became obvious to him that they had much wider applications, from education, science, and medicine to military intelligence and industrial espionage. It was on this issue that the lines were drawn for the famous suit United States versus Haddon Cybernetics. One of Haddon's chips was considered too good for civilian life, and on recommendation of the National Security Agency, the facilities and key personnel for the most advanced context recognition chip production were taken over by the government. It was simply too important to read the Russian mail. God knows, they told him, what would happen if the Russians could read our mail. Haddon refused to cooperate in the takeover and vowed to diversify into areas that could not possibly be connected with national security. The government was nationalizing industry, he said. They claimed to be capitalists, but when push came to shove, they showed their socialist face. He had found an unsatisfied public need and employed an existing and legal new technology to deliver what they wanted. It was classic capitalism. But there were many sober capitalists who would tell you that he had already gone too far with Adniks, that he had posed a real threat to the American way of life. In a Dur column signed V. Petrov, Pravda called it a concrete example of the contradictions of capitalism. The Wall Street Journal countered, perhaps a little tangentially, by calling Pravda, which in Russian means truth, a concrete example of the contradictions of communism. He suspected that the takeover was only a pretext, that his real offense had been to attack advertising and video evangelism. Adniks and Preachniks were the essence of capitalist entrepreneurship, he argued repeatedly. The point of capitalism was supposed to be providing people with alternatives. Well, the absence of advertising is an alternative, I told them. There are huge advertising budgets only when there's no difference between the products. If the products really were different, people would buy the one that's better. Advertising teaches people not to trust their judgment. Advertising teaches people to be stupid. A strong country needs smart people. So Adniks is patriotic. The manufacturers can use some of their advertising budgets to improve their products. The consumer will benefit. Magazines and newspapers and direct mail business will boom, and that'll ease the pain in the ad agencies. I don't see what the problem is. Adniks, much more than the innumerable libel suits against the original commercial networks, led directly to their demise. For a while, there was a small army of unemployed advertising executives, down-and-out former network officials, and penniless divines who had sworn blood oaths to revenge themselves on Haddon. And there was an ever-growing number of still more formidable adversaries. Without a doubt, she thought, Haddon was an interesting man. So I figure it's time to go. I've got more money than I know what to do with. My wife can't stand me. And I've got enemies everywhere. I want to do something important, something worthy. I want to do something so that hundreds of years from now, people will look back and be glad I was around. You want to... I want to build a machine. Look, I'm perfectly suited for it. I've got the best cybernetics expertise, practical cybernetics in the business. Better than Carnegie Mellon, better than MIT, better than Stanford, better than Santa Barbara. And if there's anything clear from those plans, it's that this isn't a job for an old-time tool-and-die maker. And you're going to need something like genetic engineering. You won't find anybody more dedicated to this job. And I'll do it at cost. Really, Mr. Haddon, who builds the machine, if we ever get to that point, isn't up to me. It's an international decision. All sorts of politics is involved. They're still debating in Paris about whether to build the thing, if and when we decrypt the message. Don't you think I know that? I'm also applying through the usual channels of influence and corruption.
I just want to have a good word put in for me for the right reasons, by the side of the angels. You understand?
And speaking of angels, you really shook up Palmer Joss and Billy Joe Rankin. I haven't seen them so agitated since that trouble they had about Mary's Waters. Rankin saying he was deliberately misquoted about supporting the machine. My, my. He shook his head in mock consternation. That some long-standing personal enmity existed between these active proselytizers and the inventor of preachniks seemed probable enough. And for some reason she was moved to their defense. Well, they're both a lot smarter than you might think. And Palmer Joss is, well, there's something genuine about him. He's not a phony.
You're sure it's not just another pretty face?
Excuse me, but it's important that people understand their feelings on this.
It's too important not to. I know these clowns. Underneath, when push comes to shove, they're jackals. A lot of people find religion attractive. You know, personally, sexually.
You ought to see what happens in the Temple of Ishtar.
She repressed a small shiver of revulsion. I think I will have that drink, she said. Looking down from the penthouse, she could see the gradated tiers of the ziggurat, each draped with flowers, some artificial, some real, depending on the season. It was a reconstruction of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Miraculously, it was so arranged that it did not closely resemble a Hyatt hotel. Far below, she could make out a torchlit procession headed back from the ziggurat to the Enlil Gate. It was led by a kind of sedan chair held by four burly men stripped to the waist. Who or what was in it she could not make out. It's a ceremony in honor of Gilgamesh, one of the ancient Sumerian culture heroes.
Yes, I've heard of him.
Immortality was his business. He said this matter-of-factly, by way of explanation, and looked at his watch. It's at the very top of the ziggurat, you know, that the kings would go to receive instruction from the gods, especially from Anu, the sky god. By the way, I looked up what they called Vega. It was Tirana, the life of heaven. It's a funny thing to call it.
And have you gotten any instructions?
No, they went to your place, not mine. But there'll be another Gilgamesh procession at 9 o'clock. I'm afraid I won't be able to stay that long. But let me ask you something. Why Babylon? She asked. And Pompeii? Here you are, one of the most inventive people around. You've created several major industries. You defeated the advertising industry on its own ground.
Okay, so you got whipped on that security issue on the context recognition chip.
There's lots of other things you could have done. Why this?
Far away, the procession had reached the Temple of Asur. Why not something more worthy? He asked.
I'm just trying to satisfy societal needs that the government overlooks or ignores. It's capitalism. It's legal. It makes a lot of people happy. And I think it's a safety valve for some of the crazies that this society keeps generating. But I didn't think all that through at the time. It's very simple. I can remember exactly the moment when the idea for Babylon hit me. I was in Walt Disney World, riding the Mississippi Sternwheeler riverboat with my grandson Jason. Jason was around 4, maybe 5. I was thinking about how smart the Disney people were to discontinue individual tickets for each ride and instead offer a one-day pass which admitted you to everything. They saved some salaries, some of the ticket takers, for instance. But much more important, people tended to overestimate their appetites for rides. They'd pay a premium to be admitted to everything, and then they'd be happy with a lot less. Now, next to me and Jason was an 8-year-old boy with a faraway look in his eye. I'm guessing his age. Maybe he was 10. His father was asking him stuff, and he was answering in monosyllables. The boy was fondling the barrel of a toy rifle he'd propped up on his deck chair. The stock was between his legs. All he wanted was to be left alone and stroke the rifle. Behind him were the towers and spires of the Magic Kingdom, and suddenly everything fell into place. You know what I'm saying? He filled a tumbler with Diet Cola and clicked it against her glass.
Confusion to your enemies, he toasted genially. I'll have them take you out by the Ishtar Gate.
The procession's going to make things too crowded toward the Enlil Gate. Both escorts magically appeared, and it was evident she was being dismissed. She had little desire to linger. Oh, don't forget about the phase modulation and looking in the oxygen lines. But even if I'm wrong about where the primer is, don't forget. I'm the only one to build the machine. Floodlights brilliantly illuminated the Ishtar Gate. It was covered with representations in glazed tile of some blue animal. The archaeologists had called them dragons.
Chapter 14 Harmonic Oscillator. Skepticism is the chastity of the intellect, and it is shameful to surrender it too soon or to the first comer. There is nobility in preserving it coolly and proudly through long youth, until at last, in the ripeness of instinct and discretion, it can be safely exchanged for fidelity and happiness. George Santayana, Skepticism and Animal Faith, 9. It was on a mission of insurgency and subversion. The enemy was vastly larger and more powerful, but it knew the enemy's weakness. It could take over the alien government, turning the resources of the adversary to its own purpose. Now, with millions of dedicated agents in place... She sneezed and tried to find a clean paper tissue in the bulging pocket of the terry-cloth presidential bathrobe. She had no makeup on, although her chapped lips revealed patches of mentholated balm.
My doctor tells me I have to stay in bed or I'll get viral pneumonia. I ask him for an antibiotic, and he tells me there's no antibiotic for viruses. So how does he know I have a virus?
Derheer opened his mouth to answer, a gesture in the making when the president cut him short.
No, never mind. You'll start telling me about DNA and host recognition, and I'll need what resources I've got left to listen to your story. If you're not afraid of my virus, pull up a chair.
Thank you, Miss President. This is about the primer. I have the report here. There's a long technical section that's included as an appendix. I thought you might be interested in it also. Briefly, we're reading and actually understanding the thing with almost no difficulty. It's a fiendishly clever learning program. I don't mean fiendishly in any literal sense, of course. We must have a vocabulary of 3,000 words by now. I don't understand how it's possible. I could see how they could teach you the names of their numbers. You make one dot and write the letters O-N-E underneath, and so on. I could see how you could have a picture of a star and then write S-T-A-R under it, but I don't see how you could do verbs or the past tense or conditionals. Well, they do some of it with movies. Movies are perfect for verbs, and a lot of it they do with numbers. Even abstractions. They can communicate abstractions with numbers. It goes something like this. First, they count out the numbers for us. And then they introduce some new words. Words we don't understand. Here, I'll indicate their words by letters. We read something like this. The letters stand for symbols the Vegans introduce. He wrote, 1A1B2Z. 1A2B3Z. 1A7B8Z. What do you think it is?
My high school report card.
You mean... There's a combination of dots and dashes that A stands for, and a different combination of dots and dashes that B stands for, and so on?
Exactly. You know what 1 and 2 mean, but you don't know what A and B mean.
What does a sequence like this tell you?
A means plus, and B means equals.
Is that what you're getting at?
Good. But we don't yet understand what Z means, right?
Now, along comes something like this.
1A2B4Y.
You see?
Maybe. Give me another that ends in Y.
2000A4000B0Y.
Okay, I think I got it. As long as I don't read the last three symbols as a word, Z means it's true and Y means it's false.
Right, exactly.
Pretty good for a president with a virus and a South African crisis. So with a few lines of text, they've taught us four words. Plus equals true, false. Four pretty useful words. Then they teach division. Divide one by zero and tell us the word for infinity. Or maybe it's just the word for indeterminate. Or they say the sum of the interior angles of a triangle is two right angles. Then they comment that the statement is true if space is flat, but false if space is curved. So you've learned how to say if, and I didn't know space was curved. Ken, what the hell are you talking about? How can space be curved? No, never mind, never mind. That can't have anything to do with the business in front of us. Well, actually, Saul Haddon tells me it was his idea where to find the primer. Don't look at me funny to hear. I talk to all types. I didn't mean, as I understand it, Mr. Haddon volunteered a few suggestions, which had all been made by other scientists as well. Dr. Arroway checked them out and hit pay dirt with one of them. It's called phase modulation, or phase coding. Yes. Now, is this correct, Ken? The primer is scattered throughout the message, right? Lots of repetitions. And there was some primer shortly after Arroway first picked up the signal. Shortly after she picked up the third layer of the palimpsest, the machine design. And many countries have the technology to read the primer, right? Well, they need a device called a phase correlator, but yes, the countries that count, anyway. Then the Russians could have read the primer a year ago, right? Or the Chinese or the Japanese. How do you know they're not halfway to building the machine right now? I thought of that. But Marvin Yang says it's impossible. Satellite photography, electronic intelligence, people on the scene, all confirm that there's no sign of the kind of major construction project you'd need to build a machine. No. We've all been asleep at the switch. We were seduced by the idea that the primer had to come at the beginning and not interspersed through the message. It's only when the message recycled and we discovered it wasn't there that we started thinking of other possibilities. All this work has been done in close cooperation with the Russians and everybody else. We don't think anybody has the jump on us, but on the other hand, everybody has the primer now. I don't think there's any unilateral course of action for us. I don't want a unilateral course of action for us. I just want to make sure that nobody else has a unilateral course of action. Okay, so back to your primer. You know how to say true-false, if-then, and space is curved. How do you build a machine with that? You know, I don't think this cold or whatever you've got has slowed you down a bit. Well, it just takes off from there. For example, they draw us a periodic table of the elements. So they get to name all the chemical elements. The idea of an atom, the idea of a nucleus, protons, neutrons, electrons. Then they run through some quantum mechanics just to make sure we're paying attention. There are already some new insights for us in the remedial stuff. Then it starts concentrating on the particular materials needed for the construction. For example, for some reason we need 2 tons of erbium. So they run through a nifty technique to extract it from ordinary rocks. Durhir raised his hand palm outward in a placatory gesture. Don't ask why we need 2 tons of erbium. Nobody has the faintest idea. I wasn't going to ask that. I want to know how they told you how much a ton is. They counted it out for us in Planck masses. A Planck mass is... Never mind, never mind. It's something that physicists all over the universe know about, right? And I've never heard of it. Now, the bottom line. Do we understand the primer well enough to start reading the message? Will we be able to build the thing or not? The answer seems to be yes. We've only had the primer for a few weeks now, but whole chapters of the message are falling into our lap in clear. It's painstaking design, redundant explanations, and, as far as we can tell, tremendous redundancy in the machine design. We should have a 3-dimensional model of the machine for you in time for that crew selection meeting on Thursday, if you feel up to it. So far, we haven't a clue as to what the machine does or how it works. And there are some funny organic chemical components that don't make any sense as part of a machine. But almost everybody seems to think we can build the thing. Who doesn't? Well, Lunacharsky and the Russians. And Billy Joe Rankin, of course. There are still people who worry that the machine will blow up the world or tip the Earth's axis or something. But what's impressed most of the scientists is how careful the instructions are. and how many different ways they go about trying to explain the same thing. And what does Eleanor Arroway say?
She says if they want to do us in, they'll be here in 25 years or so, and there's nothing we could do in 25 years to protect ourselves. They're too far ahead of us.
So she says, build it, and if you're worried about environmental hazards, build it in a remote place. Professor Drumlin says you can build it in downtown Pasadena for all he cares. In fact, he says he'll be there every minute it takes to construct the machine, so he'll be the first to go if it blows up.
Drumlin.
He's the fellow who figured out that this was the design for a machine, right?
Not exactly.
I'll read all the briefing material in time for that Thursday meeting. You got anything else for me?
Are you seriously considering letting Haddon build the machine?
Well, it's not only up to me, as you know. That treaty they're hammering out in Paris gives us about a one-quarter say. The Russians have a quarter. The Chinese and the Japanese together have a quarter. And the rest of the world has a quarter, roughly speaking. A lot of nations want to build the machine, or at least parts of it. They're thinking about prestige and new industries, new knowledge.
As long as no one gets a jump on us, that all sounds fine to me.
It's possible Haddon might have a piece of it.
What's the problem?
Don't you think he's technically competent?
Well, he certainly is. It's just...
If there's nothing more, Ken, I'll see you Thursday. Virus willing.
Asdor here was shutting the door and entering the adjacent sitting room. There was an explosive presidential sneeze. The warrant officer of the day, sitting stiffly on a couch, was visibly startled. The briefcase at his feet was crammed with authorization codes for nuclear war. Drahir calmed him with a repetitive gesture of his hand. Finger spread, palm down. The officer gave an apologetic smile.
That's Vega? That's what all the fuss is about?
The president asked with some disappointment. The photo opportunity for the press was now over, and her eyes had become almost dark-adapted after the onslaught of flashbulbs and television lighting. The pictures of the president, gazing steely-eyed through the Naval Observatory telescope that appeared in all the papers the next day, were, of course, a minor sham. She had been unable to see anything at all through the telescope until the photographers had left and darkness returned.
Why does it wiggle?
It's turbulence in the air, Miss President, Drahir explained. Warm bubbles of air go by and distort the image.
Like looking at Sai across the breakfast table when there's a toaster between us. I can remember seeing one whole side of his face fall off, she said affectionately,
raising her voice so the presidential consort, standing nearby, talking to the uniformed commandant of the observatory, could overhear.
Yeah, no toaster on the breakfast table these days, he replied amiably.
Seymour Lasker was, before his retirement, a high official of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. He had met his wife decades before, when she was representing the New York Girl Coat Company, and they had fallen in love over a protracted labor settlement. Considering the present novelty of both their positions, the apparent health of their relationship was noteworthy.
I can do without the toaster, but I'm not getting enough breakfasts with Sai.
She inflected her eyebrows in his general direction, and then returned to the monocular eyepiece.
It looks like a blue amoeba, all squishy.
After the difficult crew selection meeting, the president was in a light-hearted frame of mind. Her cold was almost gone.
What if there was no turbulence, Ken? What would I see then?
Then it would be just like space telescope above the Earth's atmosphere. You'd see a steady, unflickering point of light.
Just the star? Just Vega?
No planets, no rings, no laser battle stations?
No, Miss President. All that would be much too small and faint to see, even with a very big telescope.
Well, I hope your scientists know what they're doing, she said in a near whisper. We're making an awful lot of commitments on something we've never seen. Drahir was a little taken aback.
But we've seen 31,000 pages of text, pictures, words, plus a huge primer.
In my book, that's not the same as seeing it.
It's a little too inferential.
Don't tell me about scientists all over the world getting the same data. I know all that. And don't tell me about how clear and unambiguous the blueprints for the machine are. I know that, too. And if we back out, someone else is sure to build the machine. I know all those things, but I'm still nervous. The party ambled back through the Naval Observatory compound to the Vice President's residence. Tentative agreements on crew selection had been painstakingly worked out in Paris in the last weeks. The United States and the Soviet Union had argued for 2 crew positions each. On such matters, they were reliable allies. But it was hard to sustain this argument with the other nations in the World Message Consortium. These days, it was much more difficult for the United States and the Soviet Union, even on issues on which they agreed, to work their way with the other nations of the world than had once been the case. The Enterprise was now widely touted as an activity of the human species. The name World Message Consortium was about to be changed to World Machine Consortium. Nations with pieces of the message tried to use this fact as an entree for one of their nationals as a member of the crew. The Chinese had quietly argued that by the middle of the next century, there would be 1.5 billion of them in the world, but with many born as only children because of the Chinese experiment on state-supported birth control. Those children, once grown, would be brighter, they predicted, and more emotionally secure than children of other nations with less stringent rules on family size. Since the Chinese would thus be playing a more prominent role in world affairs in another 50 years, they argued, they deserved at least 1 of the 5 seats on the machine. It was an argument now being discussed in many nations by officials with no responsibility for the message or the machine. Europe and Japan surrendered crew representation in exchange for major responsibility for the construction of machine components, which they believed would be of major economic benefit. In the end, a seat was reserved for the United States, the Soviet Union, China, and India, with the 5th seat undecided. This represented a long and difficult multilateral negotiation, with population size, economic, industrial, and military power, present political alignments, and even a little of the history of the human species as considerations. For the 5th seat, Brazil and Indonesia made representations based on population size and geographical balance. Sweden proposed a moderating role in case of political disputes. Egypt, Iraq, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia argued on grounds of religious equity. Others suggested that at least this 5th seat should be decided on grounds of individual merit rather than national affiliation. For the moment, the decision was left in limbo, a wild card for later. In the 4 selected nations, scientists, national leaders, and others were going through the exercise of choosing their candidates. A kind of national debate ensued in the United States. In surveys and opinion polls, religious leaders, sports heroes, astronauts, Congressional Medal of Honor winners, scientists, movie actors, a former presidential spouse, television talk show hosts and news anchors, members of Congress, millionaires with political ambitions, foundation executives, singers of country and western and rock and roll music, university presidents, and the current Miss America were all endorsed with varying degrees of enthusiasm. By long tradition, ever since the Vice President's residence was moved to the grounds of the Naval Observatory, the house servants had been Filipino petty officers on active duty in the U.S. Navy. Wearing smart blue blazers with a patch embroidered Vice President of the United States, they were now serving coffee. Most of the participants in the all-day crew selection meeting had not been invited to this informal evening session. It had been Seymour Lasker's singular fate to be America's first gentleman. He bore his burden, the editorial cartoons, the smarmy jokes, the witticism that he had gone where no man had gone before, with such directness and good nature that at last America was able to forgive him for marrying a woman with the nerve to imagine that she could lead half the world. Lasker had the vice president's wife and teenage son laughing uproariously as the president guided Terhier into an adjacent library annex. "All right," she began. "There's no official decision to be made today, and no public announcement of our deliberations. But let's see if we can sum up. We don't know what the goddamn machine will do, but it's a reasonable guess that it goes to Vega. Nobody has the slightest idea of how it would work or even how long it would take.
Tell me again, how far away is Vega?
26 light years, Miss President. And so if this machine were a kind of spaceship and could travel as fast as light, I know it can't travel as fast as light, only close to it, don't interrupt, then it would take 26 years for it to get there. But only as we measure time here on Earth. Is that right, Jahir?
Yes, exactly.
Plus maybe a year to get up to light speed and a year to decelerate into the Vega system. But from the standpoint of the crew members, it would take a lot less. Maybe only a couple of years, depending on how close to light speed they travel.
For a biologist to hear, you've been learning a lot of astronomy.
Thank you, Miss President. I've tried to immerse myself in the subject.
She stared at him for just a moment and then went on.
So, as long as the machine goes very close to the speed of light, it might not matter much how old the crew members are. But if it takes 10 or 20 years or more, and you say that's possible, then we ought to have somebody young. Now, the Russians aren't buying this argument. We understand it's between Arkhangelsky and Lunacharsky, both in their 60s.
She had read the names somewhat haltingly off a file card in front of her.
The Chinese are almost certainly sending Xi. He's also in his 60s. So if I thought they knew what they're doing, I'd be tempted to say, what the hell, let's send a 60-year-old man.
Drumlin, Jahir knew, was exactly 60 years old.
On the other hand, he counterposed, I know. The Indian doctor, she's in her 40s. In a way, this is the stupidest thing I ever heard of. We're picking somebody to enter the Olympics, and we don't know what the events are. I don't know why we're talking about sending scientists.
Mahatma Gandhi, that's who we should send. Or while we're at it, Jesus Christ. Oh, don't tell me they're not available to hear, I know that.
When you don't know what the events are, you send a decathlon champion.
And then you discover the event is chess, or oratory, or sculpture, and your athlete finishes last.
Okay, you say that it ought to be someone who's thought about extraterrestrial life, and who's been intimately involved with the receipt and decrypting of the message.
Well, at least a person like that will be intimately involved with how the Vegans think, or at least how they expect us to think.
And for really top-rate people, you say that reduces the field to 3?
Again, she consulted her notes.
Arroway, Drumlin, and the one who thinks he's a Roman general.
Dr. Valerian, Miss President. I don't know that he thinks he's a Roman general, it's just his name.
Valerian wouldn't even answer the selection committee's questionnaire. He wouldn't consider it because he won't leave his wife, is that right?
Well, I'm not criticizing him, he's no dope. He knows how to make a relationship work.
It's not that his wife is sick or anything.
No, as far as I know, she's in excellent health.
Good, good for them. Send her a personal note from me. Something about how she must be some woman for an astronomer to give up the universe for her. But fancy up the language to hear. You know what I want. Oh, and throw in some quotation, poetry maybe, but not too gushy.
She waved her index finger at him.
Those Valerians can teach us all something. Why don't we invite them to a state dinner? The King of DePaul's here in 2 weeks. That'll be about right.
Jahir was scribbling furiously. He would have to call the White House appointments secretary at home as soon as this meeting was over. And he had a still more urgent call. He had not been able to get to the telephone for hours.
So, that leaves Arroway and Drumlin. She's something like 20 years younger, but he's in terrific physical shape. He hang glides, skydives, scuba dives. He's a brilliant scientist. He helped in a big way to crack the message, and he'll have a fine time arguing with all the other old men. He didn't work on nuclear weapons, did he? I don't want to send anybody who worked on nuclear weapons.
Now, Arroway's also a brilliant scientist.
She's led this whole Argus project. She knows all the ins and outs of the message, and she has an inquiring mind. Everybody says that her interests are very broad, and she'd convey a younger American image.
She paused.
And you like her, Ken. Nothing wrong with that. I like her, too. But sometimes she's a loose cannon. Did you listen carefully to her questionnaire?
I think I know the passage you're talking about, Miss President. But the selection committee had been asking her questions for almost 8 hours, and sometimes she gets annoyed at what she considers dumb questions. Drumlin's the same way. Maybe she learned it from him. She was his student for a while, you know.
Yeah, he said some dumb things, too. Here, it's supposed to be all queued up for us on this VCR. First Arroway's questionnaire, then Drumlin's. Just press the play button, Ken.
On the television screen, Ellie was being interviewed in her office at the Argus Project. He could even make out the yellowing piece of paper with the quote from Kafka. Perhaps, all things considered, Ellie would have been happier had she received only silence from the stars. There were lines around her mouth and bags under her eyes. There were also two unfamiliar vertical creases on her forehead just above her nose. Ellie on videotape looked terribly tired, and Drahir felt a pang of guilt.
What do I think of the world population crisis?
Ellie was saying.
You mean, am I for it or against it?
You think this is a key question I'm going to be asked on Vega? And you want to make sure I give the right answer?
Okay.
Overpopulation is why I'm in favor of homosexuality and a celibate clergy. A celibate clergy is an especially good idea because it tends to suppress any hereditary propensity toward fanaticism.
Ellie waited, deadpan, indeed frozen for the next question. The president had pushed the pause button.
Now, I admit that some of the questions may not have been the best, the president continued, but we didn't want anybody in such a prominent position on a project with really positive international implications who turns out to be some racist bozo. We want the developing world on our side in this one. We had a good reason to ask a question like that. Don't you find her answers show some lack of tact? She's a bit of a wise ass, your Dr. Arroway. Now, take a look at Drumlin.
Wearing a blue polka dot bow tie, Drumlin was looking tanned and very fit.
Yes, I know we all have emotions, he was saying. But let's bear in mind exactly what emotions are. They're motivations for adaptive behavior from a time when we were too stupid to figure things out. But I can figure out that if a pack of hyenas are headed toward me with their fangs bared, there's trouble ahead. I don't need a few cc's of adrenaline to help me understand the situation. I can even figure out that it might be important for me to make some genetic contribution to the next generation. I don't really need testosterone in my bloodstream to help me along. Are you sure that an extraterrestrial being far in advance of us is going to be saddled with emotions? I know there are people who think I'm too cold, too reserved. But if you really want to understand the extraterrestrials, you'll send me. I'm more like them than anyone else you'll find.
Some choice, the president said. The one's an atheist and the other thinks he's from Vega already. Why do we have to send scientists? Why can't we send somebody normal?
Just a rhetorical question, she quickly added. I know why we have to send scientists. The message is about science, and it's written in scientific language.
Science is what we know we share with the beings on Vega.
No, those are good reasons, Ken. I remember them.
She's not an atheist. She's an agnostic. Her mind is open. She's not trapped by dogma. She's intelligent. She's tough, and she's very professional. The range of her knowledge is broad. She's just the person we need in this situation.
Ken, I'm pleased by your commitment to uphold the integrity of this project. But there's a great deal of fear out there. Don't think I don't know how much the men out there have had to swallow already. More than half the people I talk to believe we've got no business building this thing. If there's no turning back, they want to send somebody absolutely safe. Arroway may be all the things you say she is, but safe she isn't. I'm catching a lot of heat from the Hill, from the Earthfirsters, from my own national committee, from the churches. I guess she impressed Palmer Joss in that California meeting, but she managed to infuriate Billy Joe Rankin. He called me up yesterday and said, "Ms. President." He can't disguise his distaste at saying "Ms." "Ms. President," he says, "that machine's gonna fly straight to God or the devil. Whichever one it is, you better send an honest-to-God Christian." He tried to use his relationship with Palmer Joss to muscle me, for God's sake. I don't think there is any doubt he was angling to go himself. Drumlin's going to be much more acceptable to somebody like Rankin than Arroway is.
I recognize Drumlin something of a cold fish, but he's reliable, patriotic, sound. He has impeccable scientific credentials, and he wants to go. No, it has to be Drumlin. The best I can offer is to have her as backup.
Can I tell her that?
We can't have Arroway knowing before Drumlin, can we? I'll let you know the moment a final decision is made and we've informed Drumlin.
Oh, cheer up, Ken.
Don't you want her to stay here on Earth? It was after 6 when Ellie finished her briefing of the State Department's Tiger Team that was backstopping the American negotiators in Paris. Derheer had promised to call her as soon as the crew selection meeting was done. He wanted her to hear from him whether she had been selected, not from anybody else. She had been insufficiently deferential to the examiners she knew, and might lose out for that reason among a dozen others. Nevertheless, she guessed, there might still be a chance. There was a message waiting for her at the hotel. Not a pink while you were out form filled in by the hotel operator, but a sealed, unstamped, hand-delivered letter. It read, "Meet me at the National Science and Technology Museum, 8 p.m. tonight, Palmer Joss." No hello, no explanations, no agenda, and no yours truly, she thought. This really is a man of faith. The stationery was her hotel's, and there was no return address. He must have sauntered in this afternoon, knowing from the Secretary of State himself, for all she knew, that Ellie was in town, and expecting her to be in. It had been a tiresome day, and she was annoyed at having to spend any time away from piecing together the message. Although a part of her was reluctant to go, she showered, changed, bought a bag of cashews, and was in a taxi in 45 minutes. It was about an hour before closing, and the museum was almost empty. Huge, dark machinery was stuffed into every corner of a vast entrance hall. Here was the pride of the 19th century shoemaking, textile, and coal industries. A steam calliope from the 1876 exposition was playing a jaunty piece, originally written for brass, she judged, for a tourist group from West Africa. Joss was nowhere to be seen. She suppressed the impulse to turn on her heel and leave. If you had to meet Palmer Joss in this museum, she thought, and the only thing you had ever talked to him about was religion and the message, where would you meet him? It was a little like the frequency selection problem in SETI. You haven't yet received a message from an advanced civilization, and you have to decide on which frequencies these beings, about whom you know virtually nothing, not even their existence, have decided to transmit. It must involve some knowledge that both you and they share. You and they certainly both know what the most abundant kind of atom in the universe is, and the single radio frequency at which it characteristically absorbs and emits. That was the logic by which the 1420 megahertz line of neutral atomic hydrogen had been included in all the early SETI searches. What would the equivalent be here? Alexander Graham Bell's telephone? The telegraph? Marconi's? Of course.